Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
Let's talk.
Giles Brown.
You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. White Terror follows is a fascinating piece of investigative journalism telling for the first time the story of the National Socialist Underground in Germany. This is the new book by Jacob Kushner. Delighted to say that Jacob joins me live on the line now. Jacob, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure is indeed all mine. Whereabouts are you, by the way?
I'm in New York City now.
Super. Just tell me a little bit about your background as a journalist, how this particular story crossed your radar.
Absolutely. So I'm a U.S. journalist, and I've spent most of my career abroad, and I was spending a lot of time in East Africa, actually reporting on a different sort of violence against immigrants. So I was reporting on violence against LGBTQ refugees all across East Africa. It was during that reporting that I started to hear in the news about attacks in Europe, in Germany, against immigrants. And so this was 2015, 2016. It was the height of the so-called refugee crisis. And I started going over to Germany, first on small fellowships and reporting grants and whatnot, to investigate these attacks against immigrants there, because I thought, oh, it isn't just in places like, you know, East Africa, where I was based, that immigrants are under assault. And so I would go around Germany investigating these different attacks. Far-right Germans would burn down shelters before any asylum seekers moved into them so that they couldn't move in, right? Sometimes people would burn down asylum shelters where people were living. Sometimes they would block buses from arriving at these German cities and towns, not wanting, refugees, asylum seekers, rather, to settle there. And so I went around Germany doing this sort of reporting on this sort of far-right anti-immigrant currents and attacks, and that's when I heard about the NSU, the National Socialist Underground.
It's a really interesting and delicate subject to tiptoe around, isn't it, the whole German experience? Because if you're like, this is the perfect storm. We have, for example, we have the wave of Turkish immigration in the 70s into West Germany / Berlin. Then we have the unification of Germany, and the East opens up. And, you know, I remember being a young man watching CNN and the wall coming down. But East Germany is a little different from their experience with immigration. Obviously, we have the whole 1933 to 1945 experience. We have the situation with people who were formerly involved with the National Socialist Party, because they can't do trials for everybody going back into the mainstream in West Germany. Then we have Merkel opening the borders in Syria. It's a perfect storm of immigration, and it's also a new generation of Germans whose grandfathers or whose fathers haven't been in the situation of 45, and then therefore perhaps there's a remove from the horrors.
As you point out, there's so many things to unpack here. I mean, so in Germany, if you look at, let's take the starting point of kind of the Berlin Wall falling. So you had in, you know, Western Germany by this time, as you point out, you had many Turkish people who had settled after coming over as guest workers in the West. And then in Eastern Germany, you had lots of Vietnamese immigrants and immigrants from other communist countries who had also been brought over as guest workers there. And so the wall falls and something kind of remarkable happens, which is that these people in the East, especially who were working in factories, these Vietnamese guest workers, for example, the communist state collapses, and then basically these people come and start opening stores and restaurants, and they become visible for the first time in a way that they weren't to East Germans. And so, you know, just at this time of economic crisis in Eastern Germany, which it really was, I mean, there were at one point, you know, a third of people were employed. You know, it is a serious crisis in Eastern Germany, and basically basically at that time, people start seeing these immigrants, coming out and trying to find jobs and trying to make it too. And there are a certain category of Germans, especially in parts of the East Germany where I was doing my research, who, decided to blame their economic woes on immigrants. And, some of these people, when we talk about what are neo-Nazis in Germany? There's different strains of this, but the types of people who I write about in my book, who would later become these terrorists, these anti-immigrant terrorists, these were, literal Nazi worshiping teenagers. I mean, they would, as these different friends radicalized in East Germany, in the town of Jena, where they were from, they would dress up like SS soldiers. They would read Mein Kampf by Hitler and kind of glorify him. So when we talk about the different types of strains of far right, you mentioned, of course, the sort of people who are thinking, why do we have to continue to be ashamed for our past? Why can't we move on? We didn't commit the Holocaust. That was our grandparents or people before them. And so, there's definitely people who just want to kind of move on from it. But then there's also this group, this minority that doesn't want to move on. They want to embrace these Nazi ideas. They want to embrace these white supremacist ideas and bring them back to the forefront of German political life.
Is it an ignorance of them that they don't know? They haven't been educated about how, the horrors of the Nazism and the Holocaust, and Hitler unleashes this famously, Bomber Harris says, as London is being blitzed, he says, they have sown the wind, they will reap the whirlwind. Germany is destroyed. Germany, the amount of bombing and what happens to Hamburg, to Dresden, to all the major cities is unparalleled. Forget nuclear weapons. What happens to Germany is horrendous. Presumably these are young men and women who don't know better and just think they're seduced by the same things that seduce the German people: the uniforms, the strong man, the imagery, the very simple politics that it's somebody else's fault, it is quote unquote the other, and we as Aryans are better than them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There are many ways that people come to the far right at this time in Germany. But, actually, if we look, maybe I could introduce a few of the characters from, this book to kind of point this out. So, you basically have these three friends who would eventually form the core of this terrorist group. One is Uwe Munlos, who is the son of a professor, like a working family, but a family that doesn't struggle from these sort of economic woes that other families do. He's a very smart kid in school. He's very educated. He becomes very skeptical of socialism, and then after the wall falls of capitalism. And, this is someone who he actually starts reading books about Germany's military history. And he becomes sort of obsessed with Germany's, even pre-World War II, conquests, the German Empire, the Prussian Empire, these things. And so, he kind of comes specifically, from that mindset of, oh, Germany was a great power. Why do we have to be ashamed? We should be proud of our history. And in fact, he actually does go up and serving, as most young men did at that time still, serving in the Bundeswehr, the army. And so, he is a very militaristic young individual. And then you take, and kind of politically driven, right? And then you take another one of these future terrorists, Uwe Bernhardt, who has the same first name, they're both named Uwe. So Uwe Bernhardt is just this sort of the opposite of Munlos in many respects. He's he keeps dropping out of school. He's not academically inclined. He's a rough and tumble kid. He's doing carjackings. He's in a gang. I mean, he's beating people up on the streets. He's just a guy who really likes violence. And it seems that it was only after that he becomes friends with Munlos that he starts to have a political ideology for his violence, a sort of political rationale. And so these are two of the three. And then, so those are people coming to the right in different ways, right? He comes from violence and then finds, an ideology to justify his violence. And then third, you have the third core member of the group, Beate Chepa. And so she is, sort of something like in between the two. I mean, she's actually the daughter of an immigrant. Her mom is German, but her dad is most likely Hungarian. And she basically grows up with her grandma, living. So she's someone who her family does struggle economically. Her mom struggles to find jobs, and she's. So that is a little bit representative of that view. And then and basically the three of them just sort of begin to radicalize together. But, I think the thing that attracts them to the far right in the first place as a group, at least, isn't even the ideas themselves. These are teenagers looking for a way to rebel, looking for a way to be contrary. And in Germany, there's just no better way to rebel or be provocative than to become Nazis. And I think that's where it begins. But of course, it escalates far beyond that into a very far right radical ideology. But it really does begin with just these, I think, these teenagers looking to be provocative and, you know, committing small attacks, you know, painting things with graffiti, making Holocaust jokes and all the rest.
How do they meet? Is this on via the internet? I mean, because obviously this is something that obviously turbocharges this sort of behavior.
They met at this club, which is really interesting. So after the fall of the Berlin Wall, Germany's Ministry of Women and I think Youth, it was at the time, decided to build these clubs across Germany where youth could go to, you know, find jobs, hang out, just kind of keep off the streets. Actually, the woman who was head of that department, listeners may be familiar with, her name is Angela Merkel. And so she and her ministry decide they're going to build these clubs across Germany, in partly in an attempt to prevent, you know, political radicalization. And just, you know, crime and these things of teenagers being on the streets, give them a safe space, you know, to be in. But the thing is, some of these centers, it really goes wrong. And that's the case in Jena, in Thuringia, where these three meet. And so basically, at least two, if not all three, met at this club where they could listen to far-right music. And there was actually kind of a leftist a guy who headed the club who, you know, would sometimes, by his reckoning, you know, tell these guys to stop their other Nazi antics and stop listening to the far-right music and whatnot. And then, you know, eventually there was a rift and the three were kicked out of that club. But for a while, that club that was actually meant to do the opposite kind of served as a safe space for these three to radicalize right there under the nose of, you know, in a government funded club, essentially.
And just the way you've got the sort of the clever one who can justify, you know, the far right policies. You've got the brown shirt. You know, basically, he's now got a reason for beating people up because he likes the violence, and you've got the girl. So this is the unholy triumvirate, if you like. Why do they decide what sparks them? Because I'm thinking Baader-Meinhof. I'm thinking the flip side of Baader-Meinhof here, with again young people out to shock. You know, they start sort of bombing and killing who they think are sort of right wing anti, you know, because they're sort of Maoist or whatever. What is the spark that makes them go further than just telling inappropriate jokes? You know, shocking people by wearing SS uniform, what insignia? What's the spark that actually calls them into action?
That's a great question. And I think part of the answer is a man named Tino Brandt. So these three are actually part of a larger movement across their state, a far right movement led by this guy, Tino Brandt, who actually turns out to be a government informant, although he doesn't seem to be giving the government much information of use. And so there's this whole network that he starts called the Thuringian Homeland Protection. And these three start traveling over to different towns and cities to go to far right rallies, to go to concerts, far right concerts. And then Tino Brandt actually, famously, or infamously, I guess you could say, over about a decade is suspected of by police of orchestrating more than 30 different attacks against leftists and against graffiti, organizing graffiti of like Jewish graves and all of these sorts of different things. And these three friends kind of radicalize under him. So Tino Brandt works at a far right publishing house. He gets far right authors to come in and speak to people. They have drunken events where they music events and all sorts of things. But so basically, you have to remember these three are radicalizing in a larger movement, and that encourages violence against leftists and all sorts of people. But I think the reason they start to, these three who start by making Holocaust and anti-Semitic jokes start to move to immigrants is that there aren't a lot of Jews around. I mean, the three do hang a dummy from a bridge that's an effigy of this Jewish leader, Ignaz Bubis, but they kind of run out of Jews to target, and they start looking at immigrants. And so they basically start leaving. They start tinkering with explosive materials. They start leaving bombs, some of them in different states of completion in different places. They leave a bomb in a stadium in Jena, a soccer stadium that children discover after police failed to discover it. Some kids came across it when they were playing in the stadium. And then they leave a bomb outside Jena's public theater. These different threats that make, and they leave notes with them often that are kind of anti-Semitic threats or anti-immigrant threats. So the three are, again, I think fooling around, having some fun, showing their power at first. But then, as you point out, Eventually, something escalates, and they decide to really escalate their attacks. And all that happens one day in Jena in the early 1990s, when excuse me, 1998 rather, when basically police finally, who have been on the trail of all these far right people across the state, including these three friends, they finally go to raid the garages where these three have been building bombs. But the police, as they're raiding the garages and discovering all of these bomb making materials, and they're that these three friends have been amassing, the police let the three friends slip away. And so this is a moment, a crucial moment of failure by the authorities that allows these three terrorists to get away. And then they go on to live the rest of, for two of them, the rest of their lives, and three of them, and the third for 12 years, to go on living and hiding. And it's once they're on the run that they decide to actually escalate their attacks, because they have a little bit less to lose. They are no longer at home. They're no longer in their out among their friends in their town of Vienna. And so now that they're on the run, they decide, well, why don't we kind of escalate our anti-immigrant beliefs and kind of put it into action.
The thing that my listeners will be probably thinking is, hang on, this is the 90s. I mean, the end of the war is like 50 years or whatever before all that. This is still fresh in the memory. How can the German police, I know it's a democracy, but allow far, because we're talking Germany here. You know, I'm British. I was used to the National Front and football hooliganism and that sort of thing, and those marches. But this is Germany. And so if your politics are far right and you're going to far right meetings in Germany, you would expect the German police, the more liberal, society that Germany now is, to come down like the ton of proverbial bricks on these guys. So why is it incompetence? Is it they don't think it's a threat? They just think it's a stage they're going through? I mean, why are the German police not organized? Is it just a case of incompetence? Are we talking a cover-up? Because obviously, as I mentioned before, a lot of West Germans in the 50s, 60s, 70s had pasts at, at various levels of government. Why are they so lax in arresting or monitoring these guys, Jacob?
I think it's a combination of a few different things. One, it is true that many police officers have far-right sympathies and tendencies, and that's true even if you look at kind of studies and polls today. There still are. Well, I mean, also if you look at just kind of attacks that have happened in Germany in recent years that have involved members of the military or even plots by police officers themselves and attacks by police officers themselves. So, that's one thing, is that I think there are a lot of sympathizers there. But I want to introduce listeners to another thing, which is Germany's intelligence services. So basically, this guy Tino Braun, who was orchestrating kind of the far right scene in Thuringen, as I mentioned, he was a government informant. He was getting taxpayer Deutschmarks and then euros which he was investing in the scene. So he actually took German taxpayer money and invested that to build the far right scene and all of this. And so Germany, if listeners will recall that during World War II, of course, there was the Gestapo, which relied heavily on informants to out Jews and all sorts of minorities. During the lead up to the Holocaust, during the Holocaust. And then, of course, you have the Stasi, one of the most infamous informant networks in history in East Germany. And really, I think there's a holdover, and a lot of Germans believe this too, in terms of Germany's severe, I think, over-reliance on informants, which is a very dangerous thing. So Germany, to this day, it's unclear exactly how many far-right informants Germany has. But part of the idea is, oh, if we pay informants within the far-right scene, we will get word of any kind of potential attacks or threats to constitution. This is something that law enforcement around the world does. They use informants. But the tricky thing is, if you rely too much on your informants, or if you keep giving them money when they're not producing much of use, in the case, this is what happened in Jena in Germany, is the intelligence services ended up building the very extremist far-right scene, or contributing to that scene, the very scene that they were supposed to be monitoring and stopping from escalating into violent acts. And so basically, I think a lot of the blame on the authorities should rest with not just the police officers who maybe, and then prosecutors, frankly, who weren't charging these far-right crimes seriously enough, but a lot of it rests on these intelligence agencies that actually protected their far-right informants from prosecution, like they did with Tino Brandt, protecting him at every time. This guy, Tino Brandt, at one point, police go to raid his home and take his computer. And it turns out that intelligence agent tipped him off the night before to that. So Tino Brandt shows up at his door with his computer, ready to hand it over to the police, smiling there, early in the morning, hands it over. And what's missing from the computer is the hard drive. He's taken it out and disposed of it already. And so, this is, a blatant, action by a government handler, a government informant, rather, To you know being tipped off and essentially thwarting any sort of police action against him. So that's a big part of the problem, I think, in Germany, and you see, and many people say it's still a problem today, is this far over reliance on informants.
And then there's the way that you look at the people they're attacking, the quote unquote immigrants. And I said this is a word that we know as well, because you see that the language used kind of changed. So, for example, in the UK, we are now going on about, you know, Albanian gangs. We're talking about these mafias coming over here. And this is the sort of this, and Germany goes through the same experience, because when these attacks start, the way they're framing the victims of these attacks is, well, you know, these are, you know, as a certain president would say, these are very bad people.
Yeah, let's talk about these attacks, actually. I think we should, this is a good time to mention. So these three friends, along with the help of many others, they're living on the run, and they start, escalating. First, they start robbing banks, and they end up successfully robbing about 15 banks in Germany in the 2000s to fund their terrorism. And then they use that money both for their apartments, for their explosives, all sorts of things. And basically, you know, throughout the 2000s, as my book kind of chronicles, these terrorists and their friends are going around Germany murdering and bombing immigrants. And these are many immigrants from Turkey, for the most part, or the sons or sons of immigrants from Turkey. And basically, they essentially get away with this because of the actions or inaction of police. Because every time, for example, a Turkish immigrant would be murdered, the police would just assume that that Turkish individual or that family was involved in drug running, or there was some sort of Turkish mafia, or it was a political, Turkish Kurdish dispute. Police were blinded or decided to be, blind themselves to the possibility that this could be far right Germans or just Germans killing immigrants. Instead, they were convinced that, oh, a Turkish man was killed, it must have been drugs. Just really these stereotypes are what prevented police from realizing and following the evidence that there was, that this was in fact, targeted xenophobic violence by Germans against immigrants.
But this is the Turkish community who have been there since the 70s. So they are more, perhaps more German than some of the people that they're being attacked. You think of the German football team, for goodness sake, the Mannschaft, etc. Ozil. The Turks aren't exactly backwards in coming forward. I mean, what is the reaction like from the Turkish community? I mean, obviously it's a terror thing, so these people are spreading terror. But what is the Turkish reaction? And does the German police go, look, this is a Turk-on-Turk problem, don't get us involved?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, like you point out, I mean, when we're saying Turkish, when we're talking about Turkish men, being killed in Germany, we're talking about Turkish Germans, right? Many of these people are German citizens, and one of them actually was born in Germany as well. And so, you have these families that at some point, these families understand what's happening. You know, at first they trust the police. So at first, in each case of the murder, family members are telling the police everything they know, but police officers are grilling them, saying, "Tell us, you must know who murdered your husband." Just admit it to us that you were involved. Police officers would go to great lengths to lie to these families. They would show Turkish widows, these women who lost their husbands. They would show them pictures of like a blonde woman and make up a story that their husband had been having an affair with some blonde woman in another town, just to try to reduce that trust and make these women admit that, okay, I guess my husband was up to nefarious things. But of course, none of these men were up to these things. And so police went to great lengths, kind of reenacting their TV cop drama fantasies. I mean, there's a famous German TV show, Tatort, that's been going for decades, and really a lot of the actions by the police are straight out of that show. There's one case in which a Döner kebab seller who sells kebabs in Nuremberg is murdered, and then police, despite them not finding any traces of drugs or anything they're looking for in his shop, they decide to run the kebab stand for a year undercover police officers, spending tens of thousands of taxpayer euro to run this, hoping that maybe someday someone will come trying to buy drugs from them, and then they'll have evidence that it was a drug thing. And of course, that never happens because the guy didn't sell drugs. And so it's really, straight out of a TV, drama, these police enacting their fantasies. And so basically, these families are traumatized, they're upset that You know, instead of the police working to find their killers, the police are blaming them for their own deaths or their families for that person's death. And so eventually with time, these families go public with this. They start having rallies and protests. And you meet in the book some characters, including a young woman whose dad was murdered in Dortmund, who becomes one of the leaders of these, you know, protests, marching down the streets, calling on German police to stop this series of murders that the police aren't even, you know, willing to admit are far right or murders by Germans in the first place.
Is there some sort of, I don't know, if we start killing Turkish immigrants, it's going, you know, the Volk will rise up, and this is what the average people are thinking, and therefore we have to be, you know, the spearhead, if you like, not a good word to use, but you know what I'm saying? If we start this racist movement by taking out some immigrants, then, you know, the good people behind us, because we are a million strong in their deluded minds.
That's exactly right. And that is what these three friends and their larger terrorist group hope for. And so they actually, as they're committing these murders and bombings, they are creating a manifesto that is that they're going to one day release to the world to claim credit for it all. Because again, you know, police don't realize it's them, and almost nobody realizes it's them. But basically, they want to, that manifesto, when it does finally get released, it reveals that they were trying to inspire their fellow German citizens to take up this cause to rid their nation of immigrants. And so, you know, that that is exactly kind of the mission of these terrorists, is to get immigrants out of their country. And this is, remember, this is before the 2015-16 influx of refugees. This is a time when they're, especially in parts of Eastern Germany, there aren't many foreigners. There are in the West there are more, and some Western cities, but in the place where these three were growing up, and a lot of the times where they were living underground and hiding, there weren't many immigrants to kill, frankly. And so they would actually travel across Germany to Western cities for the most part to commit these attacks where there were more, you know, robust immigrant communities in the first place.
Obviously, we want people to get the book, so we're not going to give the whole ending. I'm just fascinated about how, one, two things. One, how this first came across your radar, and two, I'm just thinking back to a couple of years ago now with the far right monarchist plot that was dismantled by the police. But you kind of think, there's a network in place there. They've got weapons and they've got explosives. And so, one, how did it come across your radar? Two, are we back again to the situation where have the German people realized this fact? Because listen, we're seeing AfD is suddenly, you know, front and center of everybody's after a certain politician or a certain personality in the States is giving them airtime / social media time. So have we learnt, and how did it first come across your radar, as it was, Jacob?
Yeah, that's the big question in Germany when I started reporting there in around 2015, is, you know, how could this have happened today? So a lot of the German public is thinking, you know, once this all came out, and it comes out in dramatic fashion, so people really should, you know, take a look at the book. It's kind of startling, but you know, when this finally all does start to come out, it's, you know, the question on many Germans' mind is, how could we have missed this? How could our authorities have missed this, you know, after all of we've done since the Holocaust to atone, and then also to, you know, presumably prevent this sort of far-right, you know, violence from happening again? How could we have let it gone on for 13 years? How could our authorities have let it gone on for 13 years undiscovered? And so, you know, that was kind of as I first, you know, came across this. You know, I heard about this from a couple other journalist friends of mine who were starting to speak with lawyers for the family members. So there ends up being, if you get the book, you realize this all comes out, and there's a massive trial of some, although not all, for an interesting reason, some of the perpetrators. And so I start meeting the lawyers for some of these Turkish families who are representing them at this trial, basically the interests of the families. And that's kind of how I get, you know, kind of into the thick of it. But, you know, to kind of fast forward, you know, this is, you know, while this trial is happening from 2013 to 2017, a 5-year trial, by the way, it's crazy. And while this is happening, there are more and more attacks happening against immigrants in Germany, and other people pick up the mantle. Actually, Anders Breivik, the Norway killer who massacred, you know, bombed Oslo and then massacred all those children on that island of Utøya, ends up sending a letter to to Beate Chepa, the woman, you know, who fast forward, she ends up is in a prison cell in Germany. He ends up writing a letter from his prison cell to her prison cell, calling her a martyr and praising her for this. And so you have to remember that, especially in the last decade, there is so many instances of far right individuals and extremists kind of watching each other, radicalizing together online, radicalizing across countries. And so when you point out this kind of massive plot that was thwarted just a couple years ago, this Reichsbürger coup plot to overthrow Germany in a coup, literally, actually one of the ringleaders of that plot lived just down the river from where these three terrorists were born, and the River Saale in Thuringia. And he's an aristocrat. And actually, it's a really telling thing why this continues to happen, because after, Der Spiegel and some of the other news media described this guy as an unlikely terrorist. You know, here he is in a tweed suit, an aristocrat, technically a prince. Not the kind of, I think Der Spiegel wrote in an article, not exactly the type of person you think of as a terrorist. But that really shows that the journalists and the public and everybody is still getting it precisely wrong, because this white man, this white German man, is exactly what the typical terrorist in Germany looks like. Most terrorists in Germany, just like most in the United States, are right wing and they are white. Yeah. And so there's a lot of belief among the people who know this case well in Germany that if we continue to believe that terrorists are just Islamists and they're foreigners, this sort of thing can continue to happen, because that's actually not who the majority of terrorists are.
Really interesting that she gets a letter from the Norwegian mass murderer, because again, he thinks that his actions will start a race war, and he buys into that whole Nordic pagan ruins in the forest. We want some wonderful people, the Germania, etc. I mean, it's all so totally, totally twisted and demented, but they think they're some sort of like brotherhood of Aryans, don't they?
That's exactly right. And if you read the book, I mean, it's fascinating how this white supremacist ideology kind of ping-pongs back and forth between Germany and the United States, too. Actually, some of these far-right extremists in Germany embrace a lot of KKK ideology. They actually bring a KKK leader over to Germany who does a cross-burning in Germany, and then cross-burnings become popular in Germany in the 1990s, which is crazy, because cross-burnings used to be sort of a sort of pagan thing back in Europe like hundreds of years ago. So, there's all this interesting kind of back and forthing between white supremacists around the world, even in the 1990s when the internet was, in its infancy.
Mm. If people want the book is called White Terror. It is available now. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore as well on TRE.radio. If people want to follow you and continue the conversation, I know that there is social media and a website, because I've just been looking at it a little bit earlier. Where can they find you?
That's exactly right. You can find me on Instagram and on X and on Blue Sky, all at Jacob Kushner or Jacob_Kushner.
The book is called White Terror. In the States, it's called something different, isn't it? It's called...
Yeah, the States, the publisher calls it Look Away, a true story of murder, bombing, and a far-right campaign to rid Germany of immigrants. So if you're in the US, or you can find the red cover, Look Away, and if you're in Europe, you can find the white cover, White Terror.
The book is called White Terror. Jacob, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.